Good afternoon. My name is Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of our congressional leadership, Senators Rockefeller and Collins, our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this briefing on oral health. Our partner in today's program is the Kaiser Commission on Medicare, Medicaid, and the Uninsured, a project of the Kaiser Family Foundation, which I'm sure most of you know is one of the most respected policy voices in the health reform debate and all issues relating to care for vulnerable populations. You're going to hear from Diane Rowland, representing both the commission and the foundation, in a moment. We spent a lot of time at the Alliance focusing on how to overcome the substantial problems facing the 47 million people who don't have health insurance in this country. But by some estimates, the number of people without dental insurance is 2 to 2.5 times that number. And if there's one thing we know for sure, it's that oral health affects overall health and well-being. And we know there are profound disparities in oral health and access to care among different groups in this country. And I should add at this point that both Senator Collins and Senator Rockefeller have taken a special interest in this topic. Senator Collins is especially interested in the shortage of dental professionals in rural areas like those in some parts of Maine. And Senator Rockefeller has said many times that seeing the huge dental problems among the poor kids and adults in the little West Virginia town where he was a VISTA volunteer many years ago was one of the most moving experiences of his life. As I said, co-hosting today is the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. They've done a great deal of work on this issue, including, by the way, issuing two new publications, both of them in your packets, on this topic. And here on behalf of the Commission and the Kaiser Family Foundation today in sharing our moderation duties is one of the country's top health policy analysts, Kaiser Executive Vice President and Commission Executive Director, Diane Rowland. Diane?
Thank you, Ed. It's always a pleasure to be here and to share the podium with Ed and to be part of an Alliance briefing. But I'm especially pleased to be at this Alliance briefing because it's a topic that we too often don't cover. And so highlighting the dental issues today, I think, is a very important contribution not only to our examination of how current programs work, but especially as we begin a discussion about health reform and moving forward on broader health care coverage. What does that coverage mean and where will dental benefits fit into it, I think, is a most timely topic for us to consider. Now, certainly what we know is that one of the ways that we use our Alliance briefings is to try and track what's happened to policy recommendations and policy changes over time, and certainly the Surgeon General's report on oral health in 2000 was a real wake-up call for the need to really address oral health issues as a nation, outlining some of the key issues and challenges. It's an integral part of both physical and social health. Sometimes we think of dental benefits as outside of those, but it's actually very much a part. It impacts school attendance for children, employability for adults. Ed mentioned Senator Rockefeller's comments. I remember so clearly him talking about, as a VISTA volunteer, trying to get people jobs in West Virginia and then realizing that they really couldn't, they had poor nutrition, they couldn't open their mouths to really let anyone see the inside of their mouth when they were on job interviews, which really tended to leave them trapped in the poverty that they were living in. So I think it's a very important part of our recognition that low-income populations bear a disproportionate burden of dental disease. Poor children today are twice as likely to have untreated tooth decay as other children. There's a lack of dental coverage across the country, however. Over 100 million, as Ed alluded to, lack dental benefits. In some of the work we do looking at employer-sponsored benefits, we see that only 44% of those firms that offer benefits to their workers offer dental benefits as part of their health package. And we know that low provider participation in Medicaid has created access problems for the children who have dental coverage through that program, but they are not getting the kind of services that they need. And there's been a really low awareness among many of the importance of oral health and the need for an oral health infrastructure, and as Senator Collins has supported, a broadened workforce. It's particularly important when we think about children, and as we probably enter into the next reauthorization debate over the SCHIP program, to look at the importance of dental benefits for that population. Today, if you look at the use of services by children, you see that 78% of those with insurance actually access dental visits, compared to only 48% of the uninsured, so that it's affecting how people use the system. And as we look at the role of public coverage, clearly Medicaid covers a very comprehensive set of dental benefits, especially under the early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment, or EPSDT portion of the program, and covers one in four American children today. But we know that low provider participation there and lack of enrollment of many children in the program who are eligible really does compromise the ability of low-income children to get the services they need. We do know also that as we look at the SCHIP program, it's been less comprehensive in terms of its dental coverage to children than Medicaid, and some coverage is provided for children in all but one state, but this may be an issue that really should be looked at in the reauthorization debate again. And also, when we think about children, the coverage is, of course, far broader than that for adults. Where Medicaid coverage of dental benefits for adults is an optional benefit, it's often the first on the chopping block when the economic downturns occur, as they are now. Over half of the states provide no or emergency-only dental services, so it's not even a widely covered benefit for the adults on the program. So there are many key challenges ahead that I think we're going to talk about today to both broaden coverage of dental care, look at how the SCHIP benefit package is arrayed, try and look at issues around providing coverage for adults, including dental care as a part of what we talk about in healthcare reform and not as a side issue. And as I mentioned now twice, increasing provider participation in Medicaid and improving the oral health workforce and delivery system are challenges that go along with the coverage challenge, so that we can really start to talk about and be a nation that actually takes care of one of the most important components of our body, our teeth. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Just a couple logistical notes. By Monday, you'll be able to view a webcast of this session on kaisernetwork.org. And a few days after that, you'll be able to view a transcript both at kaisernetwork.org and at our website, allhealth.org. All of the materials in your packets are posted on both of those websites, too, so that you can share them with your colleagues. You, if you have been to any of these briefings before, know that there is a green question sheet card that you can fill out when we get to that part of the program. There are also, I think, three floor microphones you can use to ask the questions in person, and there is a blue evaluation form that we'd appreciate your filling out at the appropriate time. So take a moment to shut your cell phone off or turn it to vibrate, and I'd like to introduce the beginning of what I think is a very impressive array of panelists today to help us come to grips with this issue. Leading off is Dr. Harold Goodman, who's the Maryland State Dental Director. He's a dentist himself. Nobody in this area forgets the tragic case of Diamante Driver, whose untreated dental problems last year led to his death. Harry Goodman has led the efforts by the Maryland Executive Branch to improve the oral health situation for low-income kids in the state to make sure that that tragedy is not repeated. And we've asked him to share some of that experience with us today. Harry, thank you for coming down.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Good afternoon, everyone, and it's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to be really speaking to the Maryland case in the context of the life and death of Diamante Driver, and I think the story is a compelling one. So this is basically Maryland as a case study. This will also be a case study of my getting through this in 8 minutes. Maryland is has been called America in miniature, so I really want to emphasize that Maryland is really not the exception here. We're really the rule in terms of this situation of oral health in a particular state. Let me go to the next slide, please. DeMonte Driver grew up in Prince George's County, Maryland. Maryland being one of the five wealthiest states in the country. He came from a low-income family. It's a family that basically always had medical insurance through the Medicaid program, always had access to a primary health provider, but never to a primary dental provider. And I think that's key when you look at state Medicaid programs throughout the country. There's a well-documented case of the family trying to find a dentist for one of the five boys, and to little avail. Despite the fact that there was a full array of dentists of 26, 27 in the local area alone on this one managed care panel. DeMonte Driver's Maryland is basically, we'll talk about Maryland in the context of his life. He was probably born in the mid-90s, somewhere 95. At that time, Maryland indeed was ranked as one of the lowest in the country in terms of access to care by an ADA analysis, and no impressive dental rates have been increased since the 1970s. In 1997, we went to a managed care program called Health Choice, where we went to seven managed care organizations, subcontracting to three dental vendors, a very complicated system. In 1998, the Office of Oral Health, my office, became put in state law, and I think that's very critical because up till then, there was nobody at the table asking, what about dental? And a dental director can do that, and one recommendation certainly is that every state in this country should have a viable, strong state office of oral health with a state dental director. You can see the data that despite a wealthy state, over half of Head Start kids had untreated tooth decay and about a third of school children in the most recent survey in 2006. We finally, in 1998, we were able, when the Office of Oral Health became instituted, to work with the Medicaid program to strengthen it. And some very, very key legislation was passed to increase rates. And finally, by 2003, we actually had a significant rate increase. We also developed very, very significant loan assistance repayment program to dentists, an incentive program to help treat Medicaid children. And as you can see, the most recent data, that about 29% have had one dental service of any type in the past year, and far fewer had restorative treatment, that means fillings, and you can see that about 19% of dentists participate in Medicaid, with even a smaller proportion actually having significant participation by the $10,000 in billings. By February 2007, just prior to DeMonte's death, most Medicaid fees in Maryland were still at the 25th percentile and many below the 10th percentile, and you can see that the public health infrastructure was wanting, with only half health departments with a dental program. Federally qualified health centers, most of them had one, but most were situated in Baltimore City. We had scope of practice issues with dental hygienists not being able to practice what they've been taught to do in public health settings because they needed a dentist on site. We had physicians not routinely assisting in oral health assessments, and we have a maldistribution of care with regards to dentist and dental hygiene supplies, specifically specialists, and we also have tremendous recruitment problems in the public health sector to get dentists and hygienists. What happened next, of course, is very emblematic of what happens. Oral disease is the number one chronic disease in children. Worldwide, really. And one of the problems is if the oral disease was in the forehead or in the tip of your nose, someone would say, what's wrong? There's something there and we need to do something. But unfortunately, it's hidden in the recesses of the mouth. So if someone doesn't complain, which is often the case, unless there's pain, and when there's pain, it's too late, and if no one's looking, you have a recipe for disaster. And this was truly a disaster in a literal sense. It doesn't happen all the time. There are more cases than DeMonte Driver out there, by the way. But DeMonte, basically, no one looked until he finally went to his physician with severe headaches, the physician himself, which is also key because we need physicians to be also looking in mouths early on, and that's a key issue as well. Finally found the problem, first diagnosis, sinus infection, eventually a brain infection, went to his brain after two brain surgeries, and had seizures, 6 weeks in the hospital to get, and all he needed was that one tooth extracted. At a cost of about $250,000 to the state, DeMonte driver had all this care. The cost could have been less than $100 for that extraction, and if we've been practicing good prevention, far less. Tragedy. This is a tragedy in the greatest sense of the word. It's always tragic to lose a child. It's always tragic that a child maybe has an issue from cancer or what have you, which is just an unlucky roll of the dice. This case is so preventable, and that's what defines the word tragic in this case. He died of a brain infection eventually. He was failed both on the front end by lack of good preventive and education services and certainly on the back end by the fact that he could not get dental treatment. Lori Norris called him the canary in the coal mine. Legacy of DeMonte Driver is that a light is beginning to shine in Maryland. Secretary John Comers basically convened a very serious-minded dental action committee, which left the Rigos at the door, said, let's not talk about all the problems, let's not talk about the whining, let's come up with solutions. Basically came up with 7 main recommendations. All were eventually brought before Secretary Comers and Governor O'Malley and supported. They were supported in Governor O'Malley's budget to the tune of about $16 million, despite a very, very tough budget. And we got tremendous support from our federal legislators and our state legislators. The 7 main recommendations really are, one, we increase the dental reimbursement rates to the ADA standard of 50th percentile. That's the median fee charged by an area dentist in the region. And it's going to be a first of 3 incremental increases. The second, a single payer program to get rid of the confusion. We had the 7 MCOs with the 3 dental vendors. We're going to have 1 dental vendor for providers and patients to go to. Increase the dental public health infrastructure to the tune of $2 million a year, and that means grants out to develop the public health infrastructure. Expand the role of dental hygienists in public health clinics so that they do not need a dentist now to be on site or to even be there to first see the patient. Pediatric dental training of physicians and dentists, very, very key, not just for pediatricians, but even for general dentists to be able to treat young children. Oral health screenings required for school entrance, and to develop a unified social marketing campaign. We're going to need your help as well for federal funding, what have you. Our University of Maryland Dental School, which plays a tremendous role in as a partner in all this, also has asked for funding from the CDC. In terms of federal assistance to the states, I'm going to leave some of the discussion of the bills actually to my more accomplished colleagues on this panel. I will say that we need funding for the public health infrastructure. We need funding for salary support to help recruit dentists and hygienists. We need more federally qualified health centers, and we need also help again to develop social marketing and educational campaigns so that we can teach the public about the importance of oral health as well as be able to train physicians and train dentists to be able to link their oral health services to the public. My final thoughts. Number one, we have reference materials. We have a Dental Action Committee report. I believe it's in your handout, the executive summary. I really encourage you to look at it. It's a very, very comprehensive report. We're very proud of it. I also want to give my thanks to Secretary Comers, who has taken this personally, as have I, about the death of DeMonte Driver. And we have not let this rest. I also certainly want to thank Governor O'Malley for his support. Again, in a year where we've had a budget shortfall, he put all this money into oral health, really swimming upstream. I also want to give special thanks to our Maryland state senators, state legislators, State Senator Mac Middleton and Delegate Peter Hammond, Mac Middleton from Charles County in Maryland, Peter Hammond from Baltimore City, and a special thanks to Senator Cardin, and even more special thanks to Congressman Elijah Cummings, who has been there every step of the way and also has taken this death personally, as a personal affront to him. I either go to Yogi Berra or Plato to make things clear. I'll go to Plato this time and basically just state that this is a child that actually did see the darkness, and it's a tragedy in the true sense, but on a different sense, on a global level. If we do not take advantage of the light that has come out of this tragedy, if we run away from it, if we ignore it, then we've really missed a tremendous opportunity, and that would also be a real tragedy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Eric. Now we're going to hear from Bert Edelstein, who's a pediatric dentist. He's a professor of dentistry and of health policy at Columbia University. chairs the board of the Children's Dental Health Project, several publications of which are in your materials. He's done stints on the Hill and in the executive branch here in Washington, and he's one of the leading experts in the country on children and oral health. And we're very pleased to have you with us here today. Bert.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Ed, for the Alliance focusing their attention on this, and Diane for Kaiser focusing their attention on this issue. It's very welcomed and very timely. I was charged to essentially answer two questions. Is Diamante the canary in the coal mine, in fact? And how do we place the experience of this child's life and death in the broader context of pediatric health policy or health policy more generally? I have three perspectives to share with you today. The first is that of pediatrics, the second that of pediatric oral health policy as a policy issue, and the third that of the work of Children's Dental Health Project and the niche that it occupies here in this town. So first, the singular reason why you must, each of us must, focus on children's oral health specifically is because everything that goes wrong in people's oral health throughout a lifetime is initiated during the pediatric years. Tooth decay, which, as you heard Harry mention, is the single most prevalent chronic disease of childhood in the U.S., five times more prevalent than asthma, is established before age, and I like to pause here for people to ponder what the next word is, because it's often a surprise to people. But pediatric dental caries, early childhood caries, is established as a disease process before age two. So anything that we do after age two is no longer primary prevention. Gum disease, the single cause of tooth loss, the greatest cause of tooth loss in the U.S., is established as a disease process during late childhood and early adolescence. Oral cancer, the third major disease of the oral cavity, has all of its determinants, the risk exposures, established by time young adulthood is established. And the dynamic growth and development of the face and mouth all happen during the growing periods of childhood, along with the age at which there's the highest incidence of injury, both intentional and unintentional injury, more so than at any other time of life. So if we're going to be serious about lifelong, life course improvements in oral health, the only time to nip it in the bud is early on, and the trajectory once established can be quite negative and impactful and consequential in children's lives as they become adults. The second perspective relates to how children's oral health is actually a health policy issue and an issue, therefore, for your consideration. And there, I'd like to divide the focus into two halves, the bad news and the good news. The bad news that is that among all health policy issues that you address in your work, dental is the best example of the worst case in too many instances. Whether we're talking about access or Medicaid performance or workforce adequacy or consequences of a preventable disease or failure to prevent a preventable disease or disparities or safety net adequacy or almost any other such issue, dental is one of the most outstanding problems. Let me just give you some examples. Disease burden. A quarter of all preschoolers already have visible cavities, half by the time they enter first grade. Medicaid performance. The very same kids, 80% of whom get a medical visit in a year, only 30% get a dental visit in a year. If it can be done on the medical side, it can be done on the dental side. Uninsured. As Ed mentioned, there are 2.5 times more kids without dental insurance than without medical insurance. Consequences. They're not just the pain that we talked about earlier and that occasional tragedy like the one we've already discussed, but how about the consequences when these children are now young adults? 42% of all new military recruits cannot be deployed because of dental problems until they get their teeth fixed. They're not deployable. And once deployed, the single most common reason that people come off of active duty in their duty stations is because of dental emergencies. Safety net. Less than half of the community health centers, that backbone of the safety net, even have dental programs. Disparities. Children with the greatest needs have the least access. So whatever the policy issue, it's one that you have the opportunity to attend to. But the good news, the really good news, is that dental disease is virtually 100% preventable. And if not prevented in the first place, then it's almost 100% controllable or manageable. Tooth decay in particular is an infectious disease. It's diet-dependent. It's fluoride-protected. And yet, what we know in the science about the science of the disease and the science of behavioral interventions has not yet been well employed to reduce this disease and its consequences. There is in public health the common determinants approach to child health and well-being, and it fits perfectly because through parental empowerment, healthy environments, the support of safe and health-promoting opportunities for children, we truly stand a chance as a community, as educators, as daycare people, as school authorities, as health officials, every place where children live, play, and learn, there's an opportunity to promote the conditions under which children will not experience the kinds of disease that we've already become too familiar with. We need to redefine early childhood tooth decay prevention and control. Needed is public policy support to make that happen so that dental and dental hygiene professionals, pediatricians, Head Start and child workers, all of the people who come in contact with children can promote oral health. Much of this thinking has already been legislated, thanks in part to the hard work of Senator Rockefeller and so many others. There are 7 distinct oral health provisions in the CHIPRA Act. We'll see it again, and we anticipate that there'll be real energy by all of us here on this panel to again ensure that those dental provisions show up in the SCHIP reauthorization. But all of those ideas that I've just mentioned are already evident in such legislation. Early intervention. There's a requirement in CHIPRA that children parents have their first advice about preventing dental disease at the time of birth. Inclusion of required dental benefits. Right now in SCHIP, dental is optional. And as Diane mentioned, all but one state have reasonably robust dental programs. Assurance that the benefit does cover indeed basic needs, inclusion of oral health reporting, et cetera. So many of these things have already been legislated. The legislative language is there. It just needs to see the light of day. At least one key element was not included, and that was the wraparound coverage that would address the issue that Ed mentioned, which is that disparity between the coverage for medical services and the coverage for dental services. Also needed, according to the Surgeon General's workshop, are attention to those policies and programs that support systems of care. I'd like you to consider for a quick moment the mouth and its orphan status. Think about the functions of the mouth. Respiration, we breathe through it. Digestion, we eat through it. Sensation, we taste through it. Communication, we speak through it. Protection and immunity, our body is protected from exposure to the outside world through it. These are essential medical components of our health and our well-being. And the distinction between policy on oral health and policy on general health is just one that's not tenable. Whatever you do to consider the health and welfare of children needs to be considered for dental as well. Let me just finish up with a third perspective, a quick perspective on the Children's Dental Health Project and an announcement that I'm happy to make. I wanted to note that the Children's Dental Health Project in 8 days will become the National Oral Health Policy Center through a cooperative agreement with the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. And all of the efforts that we've made for the last 11 years to provide information and technical assistance to each of you in the community that either make policy or support those who make policy will be able to be ramped up even more. So we look forward to assisting you in any way. To sum up, let me just restate that too many children suffer too much too often from a completely preventable set of diseases. Policy action is now needed to improve the financing, to ensure competent, adequate, and available workforce, to bolster the safety net, and most of all, to empower federal programs to focus tightly on early childhood caries in its prevention and control. The number one thing that I think you can now do to get the most bang for the buck is to stem the tide of ongoing disease and turn off the tap instead of chasing after the repair of existing disease. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bert. And there is, by the way, a very nice summation of some of the bills that Bert was referring to and the dental health provisions therein in your packets, and it was put together by the Children's Dental Health Project. We're going to hear next from William Prentice. The first logical place to look for solutions to problems in dentistry is to America's dentists. And Mr. Prentice represents those dentists as Associate Executive Director for Governmental Affairs of the American Dental Association here in Washington. So we're very pleased to have you with us, and it's an important voice that we need to hear in the debate over what to do about these problems. Bill?
Thank you, Ed. I appreciate having this opportunity, and I thank the Alliance for hosting this session. I think it's very important. On behalf of the American Dental Association, and I am in charge of our government affairs, so all the federal lobbying that we do either here on Capitol Hill or with the federal agencies. And it might surprise you to learn that I would say that safely 75% to 80% of the time we spend advocating on behalf of access issues, about improving access to oral health care for the underserved. And that's either through working on it directly on some of the legislation that Dr. Goodman referenced and had up on his slides, or whether it's some of the tangential issues like fluoridation or improving the public health infrastructure or tobacco control, that they're all interrelated, and I think they're all pieces of the puzzle. And I want to compliment the Kaiser Commission as well for the excellent report that they just released today on oral health. I think that if you look at that, it gives you a very good roadmap of all the different issues that are in play and all the different challenges we face as we try to improve access to oral health to the populations that have been mentioned by the previous speakers. From our viewpoint, though, the starting point and the ending point has to be funding. There are a number of different things that can be done, but if we don't do something, if we cannot convince policymakers of the importance of improving access to oral health, and if we cannot get them to show that importance by devoting funding to improve Medicaid and SCHIP, then I think the remainder aren't going to be good enough to do the job. It's been mentioned before. I mean, I think that the number of dentists that can afford to participate in the Medicaid program varies state by state, and that's a byproduct of the fact that the program is set up as such that your state legislatures determine the funding for its Medicaid program, determines how much of that meager pot of money is going to be allocated to dental care. Historically, in state after state after state, we've seen them not do a good enough job. Dr. Goodman talked about Maryland's recent commitment to increase funding in that state as a byproduct of that tragedy. And it's tragic that it takes a child dying to convince policymakers of the importance of oral health and of the importance of that funding. But unfortunately, that seems to be the case, and it's shameful. So we think that, if we cannot convince policymakers to increase reimbursement, then the rest of it's going to be for naught. One of the things that, I've been recently telling, members of Congress, of which we have many friends on both sides of the aisle, is that, they, politicians, are very good at promising coverage and very bad at paying for care. And what we need them to do is to recognize that it's not good enough to just pass legislation expanding coverage and expanding programs if you're not going to provide the financial commitment to ensure that those mandates and those coverages can be provided by healthcare professionals. So, that is our mantra. I think as we go into the next Congress, where I think healthcare reform will be at the forefront, there's going to be a lot of talk about expanding access to care. I think our job is going to be the ankle biter, to be the one reminding people that just promising, coverage is one thing, but we need that financial commitment. One of the other topics that I've been asked to discuss actually was workforce and whether or not the dental workforce is sufficient to meet, this unmet need. You know, I don't know that we know the answer to that question, because I think that these programs like Medicaid and SCHIP have been so drastically underfunded that it's almost impossible in many states for dentists to participate in the programs and not lose money as they see each patient. It's not a matter of making money. It's a matter of how much money you're going to lose in some instances when you see a Medicaid or an SCHIP patient. I think that, you know, until we see whether or not we can get reimbursement at a level to get sufficient dentists to participate in the programs, we don't know whether there's a shortage, in all honesty. We know that there's a maldistribution. I think clearly there are parts of this country that, you know, there just aren't enough people, you know, in a given community to support a private practice dentist or a private, you know, medical professional or a supermarket. And clearly we're going to need the government to step in and come up with ways to try and get dental care into those areas where you can't have a private practicing dentist or physician. But in many other areas of the country, there are dentists. There's just a way of trying to get them into the program and get them to participate. And I think that if, you know, the numbers that Dr. Goodman showed, I think Bert, you know, knows of this as well, that if you can get reimbursement at a certain level, you're going to be able to get dentists to participate in the program. You know, and I think that's our challenge, to try and convince policymakers to do that. I should have started off by mentioning that I'm joined here by a colleague, Dr. John Luther, who is our Senior Vice President for Dental Practice, who works on a lot of access and related issues from the professional side. When it comes to the Q&A, he's going to join me up here and help answer questions, as he is the thinker and I'm just the talker. But fundamentally, I think that when it comes to expansion of these programs, the place that I think we see the most, the biggest need, other than, obviously, as I've mentioned, funding the current programs properly, is Medicaid-eligible adults. You know, as was referenced by Diane, you know, in too many states, there is no coverage for Medicaid-eligible adults for dental care, and we think that's shameful. So when I've talked to, for example, Senator Ron Wyden, who has a very prominent bipartisan health care reform bill that he's looking to push in the next Congress, and I talked to him about this and told him about this gap, he himself was appalled to find out that the federal government does not require states to cover Medicaid-eligible adults, those at the bottom end of the economic ladder, to get dental care. And when you think about the economic impacts of that and the societal impacts of that and the psychological impacts of that for that population, it's dramatic. And I can't think of anything else you could do, you know, beyond obviously the reimbursement that I keep harping on, to get more kids care under Medicaid than SCHIP than to ensure that their parents have coverage. So that if we, you know, do nothing else, I'd love to see the next Congress tackle that issue and ensure that Medicaid-eligible adults are covered under the Medicaid program. And I think that will not only help those adults, but as I said, I think you'll see many more children enter the program and get care as well. With that, I think I'll stop and I'll let you get on to the next speaker, Ed.
Thanks very much, Bill. And our next speaker, our final panelist, is Jack Bress, who is the Associate Executive Director of the American Dental Education Association, ADEA, which represents all the dental schools in the country. Jack's been lobbying us at the Alliance to hold a briefing on this topic for years, and we couldn't have put it together this time without him. He also has Hill Service in his background and a stint at ACTION, the agency that houses VISTA, the Peace Corps, and other agencies. And we're very pleased to have you finally on this panel that you've been having us hold for years. Jack?
Thank you, Ed. And thank you, Diane, for holding this. And I do believe that today's session is simply another demonstration that the profile of oral health and its value and its importance is being elevated on Capitol Hill and among policymakers. So thank you both for this attention. I would like just briefly to talk about three subjects. The first is talk about academic dental institutions, dental schools, as safety net providers. The second, I want to briefly describe one of the proposed workforce models. And thirdly, I want to tell you ADEA's, the American Dental Education Association's, position on healthcare reform. ADEA represents, as Ed mentioned, all the 57 dental schools in the United States, but also 714 dental residency training programs, 577 dental allied dental programs, more than 12,000 faculty who educate and train nearly 50,000 dental students in these institutions. Our members are in 45 states, including the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, and 44 of the 57 U.S. dental schools are part, in fact, of academic health centers. ADEA's members are dedicated to the advancement of research, the education of oral health professionals, and thirdly and importantly, the delivery of oral health care to improve the oral health of the public. And as providers of care, dental schools serve two purposes. One, they are the safety net providers for the uninsured and the underinsured. They are also dental homes to a broad array of vulnerable and underserved low-income patient populations. Second of all, they are centers for one-stop, comprehensive oral health care services, including a range of specialty services. Many, many people in this country depend upon dental school clinics for their oral health care. And the reason is unfortunately simple. There are approximately 134 million adults and children who lack dental insurance in the United States. Americans spent roughly $91.5 billion on dental procedures in the year 2006, $86 billion of which was paid either through out-of-pocket or through private insurance. Only $5.5 billion, less than 6%, was paid through public programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and SCHIP. There are currently 3,700 what we call dental health professional shortage areas, HPSAs, dental HPSAs. These are geographic areas in the country without enough dental professionals to serve the population. HHS makes those determinations. Over the past 15 years, dental HPSAs have grown, and this shows the emergence of the need, have grown from 792 to 3,527. During that same time, the number of dentists necessary to provide services in these areas has grown, the need has grown from 1,400 dentists to 9,164. Medicaid, as you know, is the major source of oral health care for vulnerable and low-income populations. All 25 million children in Medicaid are eligible for the only guaranteed benefit in any public program, and that is the Early Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment Program, EPSDT. But as you know, or as you should know, enrollment in Medicaid does not ensure receipt of oral health services. In 2005, the total combined state and federal spending on Medicaid dental services, was $3.4 billion. That is 1.3% of all Medicaid funding. Unrealistically low, as Bill has mentioned, unrealistically low reimbursement rates and cumbersome administrative requirements discourage many private practicing dentists from accepting Medicaid patients. Dental schools face a significant challenge. There's a significant faculty shortage. There are at least 400 dental school faculty vacancies, 75% of which are full-time positions. Despite our ongoing efforts, the diversity of our student population is low, only 5% African American, 6% Hispanic, less than 1% Native American, and 23% Asian. I said in spite of our efforts, and we have made a number of efforts, we have partnered with and have been funded through a number of foundations, for instance, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the California Endowment, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, and the Josiah Macy Foundation in order to address the diversity issues in dental education.
The second issue I want to talk about briefly is one that is more fully addressed in your packet. There's an article from the Journal of Dental Education which outlines three different workforce models that are presently being discussed in the country. The one I want to talk about is called the Advanced Dental Hygiene Practitioner. It is proposed by the American Dental Hygienists Association. ADA has a model, and there is one in Alaska. Let me say before I do that, though, that our policy, the association policy, supports extended employment of allied dental professionals, hygienists, assistants, lab technicians, as one way to improve oral health care delivery and availability. It is not, however, our role to develop new workforce models. Our role and our challenge is to anticipate and prepare the changes in the educational preparation of allied dental professionals. The ADHP, the Advanced Dental Hygiene Practitioners, is a mid-level oral health care provider that will leverage the existing dental hygiene workforce to have an even greater impact on the delivery of care to those in need. He or she will be educated and licensed to provide both preventive and limited restorative services to meet identified patient needs. He or she will be licensed dental hygienist, educated at the master's level, will administer minimally invasive restorative services, and will also have authority to write prescriptions, and finally will provide care in a variety of public health settings like schools and clinics and long-term care facilities. The concept of a mid-level provider in oral health is not new. Currently, more than 40 countries, including Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the United Kingdom, allow mid-level practitioners to practice oral health. I urge you to take a look at that JDE article to get a more comprehensive view of the three proposals that are out there. Let me conclude by sharing with you ADEA's point of view with regard to health care reform. Our board of directors has adopted six core value principles and has enunciated a policy statement which we bring to the table in the upcoming national debate on health care reform. I'll just identify the six principles. The first is that the availability of oral health care fulfills a fundamental human need and is necessary for the attainment of general health. Second, the needs of vulnerable populations have a unique priority. Thirdly, prevention is the foundation for ensuring general and oral health and for controlling costs within the U.S. healthcare system. Fourth, the financial burden of insuring coverage for health care, including oral health care, should be equitably shared by all stakeholders. Fifth, a diverse and culturally competent workforce is essential to meet the general and oral health needs of our demographically changing system. And finally, our nation's domestic productivity and global competitiveness are negatively impacted by the huge and growing number of Americans without health care, including oral health care. We believe good oral health is essential for general health. We believe that every American should receive the care necessary for good oral health. And so our message at this early stage in the debate is that any comprehensive reform of the U.S. health care system must include coverage and access to affordable oral health services. As the voice of dental education, ADEA believes that dental educators and researchers have a professional obligation to promote access to oral health care. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. And as Bill Prentice said, we'll now be joined for the Q&A period by John Luther, who's the Senior Vice President of ADA's Division of Dental Practice and Professional Affairs. He is a dentist himself and has worked on many of the issues being discussed today. And as I mentioned, you have the opportunity to write a question on the green card, hold it up, and someone will bring it forward. And there are microphones on both sides and in the middle that you can use to ask questions orally, and that would be healthy. That's right. Use your mouth, as Diane said. Jack, just a factual clarification. Your association, you said, includes the other dental professionals?
Allied dental health professionals. Dental hygienists, dental assistants, dental laboratory technicians.
And do you folks have positions on some of these scope of practice questions that were raised earlier? And how much, I mean, if you've got 50,000 students in your system, how well does that measure up to the hundreds of dentists we're short in the shortage areas? What are the issues involved in trying to fit the right people into the right places?
Ed, our focus is on accreditation programs, on the certification of some of these allied dental health professions, and the licensure of dental hygienists. That's our focus. We are safety net providers. We are also educators. And therefore, whatever workforce models are being discussed are fine. Our job is to teach whatever has been accepted.
Okay. Bill or John, you want to talk about that?
As I mentioned, Ed, I think one of the things we don't know is that if you properly fund these programs, you know, you'll have, I think, an army of more dentists participating around the country, I think, taking a large chunk of the problem. You are still going to have a distribution problem because there simply are areas of the country and communities that can't support, you know, a health professional. And that's where, of course, you have federally qualified health centers, you have community health centers, you have, you know, ways to try and extend medical and dental care into those areas. That will also pick up, I think, a piece of this problem.
Okay. Yes, would you identify yourself?
Hi, I'm Liz Savage, and I work for the ARC, which is the national organization representing people with intellectual disabilities, formerly referred to as mental retardation, as well as I represent United Cerebral Palsy. And all of the issues you underscored, lack of adequate reimbursement, et cetera, are key issues for us. But the individuals we represent, both children and adults, have an additional barrier to dental care, and that is often due to the significance of their disability, they have difficulty in communicating with dental professionals. And dental professionals, they often need anesthesia, for example. They're often much harder to treat and have harder access issues. So I have two questions. One is, with respect to the workforce shortage, I've heard that there's been legislation introduced to provide loan forgiveness for dental students. And I don't know if anyone is familiar with that, like there is for medical and other forms of loan forgiveness, tuition forgiveness, to encourage more people to go into the profession.
Jack? The average dental student comes out of dental school with about $172,000 debt. We have been advocating for some time for an increase in provisions that would either forgive or at least grant some relief for these loan programs. Some of them have been included in the Higher Education Act. We are continuing to work on more of them, but there are certainly loan programs for dental students and allied dental students.
And to speak to the population that you're talking about, there is a special care dentistry association, which are dentists who specialize in trying to treat the developmentally disabled, people with special needs, the frail elderly. Mm-hmm. We are working with them and hope to have a piece of legislation that we can get introduced in the next Congress to try and address the fact that there aren't enough dentists that are trained to treat those populations, as well as to try and get an increased Medicaid match to help out to ensure that there is a funding stream to get those people the dental care that they need.
Well, there are many of us in the disability community who would love to work with you on that.
Great.
I just like to add, in Maryland, we have something called the Maryland Loan Assistance Repayment Program, and I think it's a leader in the country because it doesn't require a dentist to be in a health profession shortage area. Essentially, we look at the whole state as a shortage area, and they receive, and we need more funding, but they receive about $100,000 for a 3-year commitment to treating Medicaid children, a certain proportion of their population base. And I really think that should be a model for the country as well. It has really worked well in Maryland. We just need to up it because, as Jack said, it's $172,000 loan indebtedness. And I think that is one of the reasons why we can't get as many dental students as we want to go out into the community and treat these special populations, because they have to hit the road running making income because they're already, behind the eight ball just through their dental debts.
Jack is way low on tuition for dental students today. The majority of these schools now are some $70,000 and $80,000 a year times 4 years.
Good afternoon. My name is Natalia Sanchez, and I'm a health policy fellow this summer in the office of Senator Snow, but actually next month I'll be starting dental school at the University of Connecticut. So my question is actually directed to Mr. Prentice and Mr. Luther. I always wondered why the American Dental Association didn't mandate or require from graduating dental students a year of real rotation. I understand that this is a program which many other countries have, whereby graduating dentists go off for a year and serve in an underserved clinic or an area of safety net dental clinics. And I always thought that would be a fantastic way to offer services, and that would just be a part of their education.
That is a debate that's going on within the American Dental Association right now, that the concept of a fifth year of service, both for the fact of getting additional training and developing additional skills as a new practitioner, as well as obviously creating a small army of new dentists who might be able to go out and work in community health centers and rural health centers and help to provide care, and that's something that we're actually actively considering. There clearly aren't enough residency programs in this country right now, dental residency programs. There's obviously, a battle competing to try and get into those residency programs, and we'd love to see if we can do something about that. John, anything you'd like to add on that?
So we are looking at it, as is looking at it right now, but again, we have to, even if we do something like this, we have to have slots for those students in their fifth year, and we also have to have, they have to be paid adequately.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I might add that we graduate 4,500 dental students a year. There are currently only about 2,500 residency slots in the country. They are very competitive. We have as many as 28 or 3,000 applicants for those 2,500 slots. So there is a challenge. ADEA encourages every dental student to pursue graduate education, but we are faced with the reality there simply are not enough slots to accommodate as many dental students, graduates, as would like to attend a residency training program.
And I'd like to follow up on Jack's comment about the need for postdoctoral training in dentistry. I teach at Columbia University in the city of New York, and New York State recently mandated that all dental students must complete a year of postdoctoral training. That has led to an increased development of postdoctoral training opportunities. So it's a bit of a push-me-pull-me kind of relationship. The mandate then does lead to more interest in developing these. And with regard to care of people with special needs, These advanced training in general dentistry programs, as well as the specialty programs, do far better prepare students to be able to care for special needs populations, as well as to serve more underserved people. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Roberta Downing, and I work for Senator Sherrod Brown. Senator Brown was actually just here and had to leave after the last speaker for his next appointment. But I hadn't heard anyone mention Senator Brown's bill, so I thought I would make a plug for it if there are any Hill staffers in the room, because we would really love to have more co-sponsors, and it really speaks to a lot of the issues that have been raised today. It is S-2723. It's actually named after Diamante Driver. It's the Diamante Driver Dental Care Access Improvement Act, and it was introduced by Senators Brown and Cochran. And actually, we worked on a bicameral basis, which is kind of unusual, with Congressman Cummings' office to introduce that bill. The bill has been endorsed by the ADA and the Children's Health Project, and it has grants so that it has grants to community health centers to expand the dental services that they can provide. It has grants for pediatric training. There's a tax credit for dentists to serve uninsured CHIP and Medicaid patients to provide an extra incentive given the problems that we do have with reimbursement. It also has a grant to test out a mid-level provider has some provisions for around dental quality. So we would love to have more co-sponsors, and in the future for the presenters, we'd love to have it advertised more widely. Thank you.
Roberta, thank you. And, Sherrod has always been a very strong, proponent of improving access to oral health. He's been a great friend of ours for many years. There are a number of legislators on both sides of the aisle that have been really good friends that have really stood up to try and improve access to oral health, Sherrod being one of the top ones. And so I wish I had noticed he was there, or I would have called on him myself.
Hi, yes. My name is Whitney Wyckoff. I'm with Congressional Quarterly. And I have a question about the dental health service, underprovided service areas that you were talking about earlier. And, because I know that in rural areas, some children who have trouble accessing general dentists have even more trouble accessing specialists. For example, in Illinois, in some rural counties, children's families would have to drive up to 100 miles to find a specialist that can address the specific needs of their children. And so I want to know if these areas that have been calculated take into consideration a lack of access for people who are on government-provided insurance, and if it also considers specialties. So that's my question.
Well, I'd be happy to address the specialty issue. It does not consider specialty care. And if you just take a look at the numbers, you see what the issue is for specialty care. Children with the greatest needs are the kids who have the least access to care, but there are only about 4,000, maybe tops 5,000, practicing pediatric dentistry specialists in the country. Now, we do make a real effort through dental education to ensure that general dentists can provide a substantial amount of care, but those kids who have really significant problems, particularly if they're very young or if they have special needs, or they have very severe disease, find themselves in need of the specialist. And the number of specialists is only about a tenth of the number of pediatricians. It gives you sort of a frame of reference to appreciate how severe the inadequacy of pediatric dentists is.
The situation you describe also is sometimes handled by the dental school clinic or a satellite clinic that is operated by the dental school. Third and fourth year students plus residents, people who have graduated and are now doing a residency training program, are available frequently in those dental school clinics. So, for instance, I think you mentioned Illinois. In downstate Illinois, Southern Illinois University has a dental school. I'm sure it has at least three satellite clinics. Certainly the school has a clinic. This is part of the mission being of dental schools being safety net providers. There is an opportunity in that situation, in many cases, to have access to a resident, a specialist, where other areas might not provide that opportunity.
And this is an area where innovative approaches to solving these problems can be looked at, such as the use of telemedicine and teledentistry, and then also perhaps having a mid-level provider that can triage care so that a dental or medical provider can come in on a part-time basis and see those with need.
Dr. Luther, could you expand on what telemedicine and teledentistry would mean in a dental practice?
It would be the use of telecommunication for a dentist or a specialist in a remote site to be able to clearly assess a situation, and then when he or she comes in to actually treat the patients, have everything set up and be ready to go. And again, it increases productivity for someone having to travel a great distance.
Okay, thank you.
But the issue I want to discuss is...
you want to identify yourself, sir?
I'm Tate Heuer with Senator Pryor's office. And concerning working families that don't qualify for Medicaid today and how they could potentially be impacted through health reform, I know that there's been a lot of discussion of modeling health reform proposals for the uninsured or for small businesses to reflect the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, which really doesn't have much in terms of standard dental care, but I believe it is in the second year of a program that has supplemental, non-subsidized dental care. And, you know, people talk about modeling health reform after the health care that members of Congress have. Well, that's the health program that federal employees have that are also people that would work, you know, doing laundry at an Air Force base or part-time postal employees. And can you talk a little bit about how the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program works and how good of a model that would be in trying to get coverage to working families today that are uninsured and hopefully will get coverage through new federal efforts?
Anybody? Bert?
It doesn't. It doesn't work. Citing the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan or state employee health benefit plans or the largest managed care organization in a state are good examples of how the disconnect, the historical disconnect, between dental coverage and medical coverage is manifest. These do make sense when policymakers are seeking to emulate the commercial environment, but because the commercial environment has that historical accident of excluding dental and making dental a separate system, we end up with a model that really has no direct application. I'm speaking specifically about children. I recently completed an analysis of state employee health benefit plans and found that very few states mandate or provide, I should say, a dental benefit for dependents. A few more states make it a buy-in option, and many states had not even the availability of such an option.
Diane?
You know, I think it's important to note, as I said in my earlier comments, that over half of the employers that offer health benefits to their workers don't include dental benefits as a part of that. And even when they do offer dental benefits, they're sometimes very limited contributions to a limited plan. So to answer your question about modeling, most of the modeling efforts that go on around healthcare reform are based on either the employer packages or slimmer packages even than the employer package, and dental benefits, I can assure you, are rarely included in the cost of coverage that the modeling efforts are coming up with.
And if I could just follow up on that, because it's really almost a misnomer to refer to it as insurance, because as Diane mentioned, in almost all instances, it's actually a prepaid dental benefit with a very limited, you know, amount of funding, you know, or coverage for a given year.
As the previous speakers have mentioned, This question is a good example of the reality of oral health vis-a-vis general health. There's a separation not only of the financing and delivery system for oral health, but also the education. There's also an attitude that ascribes a lower priority to oral health than to general health or to medical health. So that's the challenge. That's the part of the debate we're focused on in a larger context of healthcare reform. How do we get people to value and appreciate the importance of oral health and to see it as adjunct to general health?
We actually have a question that says, if dental health is so critical to overall care, why are we separating these and seeking to raise dental care to parity with medical care instead of really integrating the two? And I think that's what you've all been speaking to and answering this one question. We'll go back to Mike.
Good afternoon. My name is Nicholas Gordon. This summer I've worked in Congressman Jim Clyburn's office as a Barbara Jordan health policy scholar. And I will also be attending dental school in about a month. And so my question is, Mr. Bresch, you've talked a little bit about efforts to increase diversity in dental schools and the fact that despite efforts, dental schools are still not as diverse as we would like them to be. And as a product of some efforts to increase diversity, you know, I feel that they were very effective for me. So my question is, what, I guess, have we learned from all this? You know, what does work, what doesn't work? I'm not sure if you could speak a little bit on that so that we can move forward and make sure that dental schools are reflective of the general population.
We are in collaboration currently over a three-year period with the Association of American Medical Colleges, AAMC, whereby we take 1,900 students, 333 dental, 1,564 medical. These are college freshmen and sophomores. We take them away to 10 different sites, usually with medical schools and dental schools, and basically give them basic science courses so that they're better prepared to take the admissions test for dental schools or for medical schools. We've got to get young people early in the process, as early as grade school. We've got to show them the importance and the significance of this health profession. It's too late. They don't have the scientific background. They don't have some of the educational tools that are necessary. So this program that we're collaborating with AAMC is an effort to bring underrepresented students up to speed so that, in fact, we can have a larger proportion of minority students in our dental schools. It's the numbers are not impressive, and we don't pretend they are. Without being defensive, we wonder, without our efforts, if the numbers wouldn't even be lower. But we've got a huge challenge because we are talking about an increasingly demographically different society. We are talking about the reality that minority healthcare professionals tend to go back to their communities to treat their populations, and we simply don't have enough minority healthcare professionals.
I'd just like to add that we absolutely need minority representation in our schools and in our professions, but we need to also make sure that we create a system that they're able to, once they graduate, to truly be able to treat the population that they need to treat. I mean, or we're going to have the same issues basically, regardless, because with loan indebtedness, what have you. There are just tremendous barriers, and with low reimbursement through Medicaid programs, through restricted coverage, you're going to have the same barriers, really, as any other practitioner. So the system really needs to work for everybody, and obviously we have to get that representation in, but it's not going to be effective unless we fix the Medicaid program and similar situations, similar programs, so that you're able to truly treat the population you need to treat.
That's the microphone.
Yes, good afternoon. Susan Polydorf, and I'm a public health dental hygienist from Montgomery County Health and Human Services. I would like to ask Mr. Prentice, in light of Mr. Bresch's talk about the three levels of mid-level providers that he mentioned, Minnesota just passed, and the governor signed it in the spring, the licensure of the ADHP, the Advanced Dental Hygiene Practitioner. And I know that that legislation was proposed by Ann Lynch, District 19 legislator, and supported by the safety net providers. And I'd like to know if the American Dental Association has supported that and what they will be doing to make sure that that program does go and is a success in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
My understanding is that what the state of Minnesota passed was requirement to establish an oral health practitioner model, and that the exact specifics of what the scope of that provider is haven't been set yet, and that the legislation created a study commission to help lay that out. I know that there are representatives from organized dentistry from the Minnesota Dental Association as part of that study group. At this point, I don't think we know what the outcome of that is, though.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Lynn Hange, the executive director of the Campbell Hoffman Foundation. We're located in Northern Virginia, and one of our main focus areas is on oral health. I have one comment and one question. My comment comes from a convening of oral health safety net providers that was done recently in my region, and among them was a representative from one of the nine hospitals in Northern Virginia, who told us that in last year, there were over 480 individuals who came to the emergency department of that hospital for oral health reasons. That's potentially multiplied by nine, because there are nine hospitals in our region, although we don't have the stats for that yet. So if you have any comments about the increase in oral health urgency among adults in emergency rooms, I'd appreciate that. The other thing I have for you is a question. I understand that health profession shortage area definition calculations are in the process of being reviewed and potentially changed, and I'd like to know if the rules of the game then are also likely to change as applies to dental health profession shortage areas. Thank you.
There's no question that treatment in an emergency room significantly drives up costs of oral health care. And I think all of us would agree that we would want to drive treatment to early intervention, prevention, and then also behavioral changes.
Regarding the emergency room issue, in Maryland, an emergency room visit costs approximately $300 per visit. And as you well know, what the patient basically receives is not definitive treatment, but just basically prescription and an assessment. And then they can often be back within a certain period of time to once again charge the state at an additional cost. Again, my earlier slide, this all could be averted if we had early intervention at a far lower cost in terms of preventive services. We also have OR cases where children are seen. As Burton said earlier, by the time a child's two, it's often, or three, it's too late. And children are placed into an operating room facility to get the care done at a cost to the state of, anywhere between $3,000 to $5,000 a case. Again, compared to providing some basic preventive services at a far, far lower cost. It really is an amazing situation.
And I'd like to note that although children have far better coverage because of Medicaid and SCHIP, although those programs so profoundly and so often fail them, they often end up in the emergency room as well. Now, your question was about adults, but the kids often end up in the emergency room as well, where, again, palliative care just buys them a little time until the next toothache. But Harry also mentioned the operating room and the extreme costs that are involved in that treatment. One of the things that really drives home the importance of understanding the disease process and dealing with the disease process such that we cut off the tide of new disease is that 40% of children who have extensive and expensive dental rehabilitation in the operating room have new cavities within 2 years. And I don't know of any other surgical procedure that we would subject preschool children to with a couple of hours of general anesthesia that has that kind of a failure rate. So we really need to get down to the fundamental issues of disease management and apply those principles from pediatrics to the dental care of children.
Bill?
Well, and to build on what Bert and Harry were saying, it's, you can pay me now or you can pay me later.
And if we devote sufficient resources to these programs now and get that early intervention and get them on the road to, you know, to children starting out with good oral health and getting infusing them with the idea of prevention and of doing just basic oral hygiene, we're going to end up with a, you know, within a population as adults that are not going to have nearly the severe oral health problems that we currently face. So if we can just devote a small amount of money now to get to fix this problem, we're going to save a lot of money on the back end.
We actually have a number of questions that came from you, the audience, related to early intervention, even in a more broad-based way. First, we have questions about the relationship between the infant feeding method, bottle formula, and children's oral health. And then we have a question about maternal prenatal oral health and its impact on the children and what can be done about it. And most finally, by the time children get to school, what does the nutrition program in the schools have to do with oral health? What more can be done to bring in fluoride health-focused activities in the school situation? So how can we intervene more broadly?
As a layperson, on a lot of these issues, you know, one of the things that you might find surprising is we spend so much of our time just fighting for fluoridation and trying to just maintain the fluoridation in the places that it exists because, you know, there is such distrust for science in this country and so many different places that get their information that we are just, you know, we actually get attacked for trying to fluoridate water, supporting fluoridation in various communities, which is probably the cheapest and most effective way, you know, to try and you know, stem this disease. So, you know, if we could just, you know, get that off the front burner, not have to spend so much time just trying to defend fluoridation, and we'd have so much more time to be able to focus on all of these other problems.
So Diane asked me to address moms, and the issue there is that dental caries tooth decay, which used to be called early childhood tooth decay, used to be called baby bottle tooth decay to reflect the high frequency exposure of sugar from the bottle that keeps this disease process active. But the other, it's now more appropriately called early childhood tooth decay or early childhood caries to represent the population that's affected because it's not as tightly related to the bottle. There are other feeding mechanisms, sippy cups, and other frequent ingestion of sugar-laden foods that keep the process going. But with regard to the moms, dental caries is an infectious transmissible disease. The bacteria that initiate the disease are typically acquired by children from their mothers. So we can pick out, even prenatally, those potential children, those future children, who will be at the highest risk of experiencing tooth decay, early tooth decay, based upon their mother's dental experience. And so there are interventions, science-based interventions, that could be applied. But this calls into question the application of concepts of primary prevention, risk assessment, disease management, disease suppression. But we're in a policy forum today, so let me show you how we can quickly relate those both to practice and to policy. The clinicians have responded to this knowledge by expanding their concern for early childhood intervention. So the American Dental Association, the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and others now endorse beginning dental care at age one, and the notion of the dental home and infant oral health care. But on a more policy, that's a clinical policy, on a more public policy basis, there are a number of opportunities to apply this scientific knowledge to changes in public policy. First off, NIH could do much more work than it has in recent years on whether through the Institute for Child Health and Human Development or whether through the National Institute for Dental and Craniofacial Research on dental caries management and prevention. Secondly, over at CMS, there could be more of a focus on using incentives to attend to early childhood oral health care and the use of transformation grants, as have been used in other programs, to institute local and regional efforts to develop systems for early intervention. Over at CDC, if there were as much attention to early childhood tooth decay prevention as there is to fluoridation, much could be done. And at the USDA, the Food and Nutrition Service, the WIC program could have a potentially powerful role in dealing with the dietary aspects of this early onset disease. So there are a number of federal programs that require authorization and appropriations from this Congress that could have their attention turned to primary prevention and disease suppression.
I think with regard to the prenatal care issue, it's also one that we talked about, the gap of coverage for adults under Medicaid. We obviously cover pregnant women at a very higher income level to try and ensure healthy infants are born to those mothers, but don't include dental benefits as part of the package that they're included for.
And I would be remiss if I failed to mention the growing evidence of a relationship between prenatal oral health care and successful full-term deliveries. So that's one of the many examples of the oral systemic connection and the impact of improving oral health on other health outcomes.
Mary? And I'd just like to add also, before this is not before forgotten, is that the perfect venue for a lot of this are the schools, where a lot of this can be applied. And I think school-based health centers provide an additional venue to provide oral health care. And schools themselves can be used to provide services and certainly link services into dental treatment. I think the model for that is the Head Start programs, and Head Start basically targets all the populations that Bert was just discussing. Actually, early Head Start, most people don't know, actually begins with pregnant women and targets children up to the age of three, and then Head Start takes over from there, 3 to 5 years old. And Head Start is a perfect venue, and what Head Start does is they have daily toothbrushing exercises using fluorides all the time. And Head Start, of course, has performance standards to address dental. So the school as the venue, so we don't have that issue maybe how to get the students to the dentist or the hygienist. We have the target population right there that we can provide a number of services and then through certain creative mechanisms link them into definitive treatment, restorative care if needed.
There's also legislation before this Congress to improve the food choices available to kids in schools that we've supported so to try and give the children healthier choices when they're in the school so that they don't have quite as often an opportunity to reach for a sugary snack, that they can reach for something that wouldn't have as bad an impact on their oral health.
We have just about 10 minutes left, and we have a couple people standing at the microphones. I know we're not going to get to all of the cards. But let me also take this opportunity to ask you to pull out your evaluation forms and start filling them out as you listen to these last exchanges. And, Bob, you've been very patient.
I'm Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. I'm very excited by the last exchange because it seems like the approach to dental care involves more than just reimbursing physicians. It has to do with the way the whole community functions and the interventions of the school and the water supply and all of these things. I'm wondering if the model for universal health care really doesn't lie in the example of more effective and cost-effective dental care. It seems like the whole panel has been talking about how parallel general health care is to dental care, and we haven't really made a good argument about the cost savings for universal health care, at least politically, even if the public favors it. And so I'm wondering if the examples that you're advocating here wouldn't lend itself to demonstrating the advantages of universal dental care first, and the kinds of interventions that you have just been talking about. Wouldn't there be cost savings to society if those things happened, and wouldn't the mechanisms already exist at the community level for implementing that?
I don't know that I can answer you know, that in depth and detail. The one thing I would offer is that dental care, when it works properly, is completely prevention-based. And obviously, if we could do that on the medical side, the way it's done on the dental side when it's done successfully, I think that might be a recipe for improving oral and medical and, you know, overall health in America.
I would remind you that the third core value with regard to our health care reform position is that prevention is the foundation, not only for ensuring general and oral health, but also for controlling costs. So certainly, a dollar spent on prevention is many dollars saved on treatment down the line.
We'll have Peter Orszag on this panel the next time we have it.
Karen Sealander with McDermott, Will & Emery for the American Dental Hygienist Association, and I've got a comment and a question and a point of clarification. First, thanks so much to Kaiser and the Alliance for hosting this briefing and drawing attention to the importance of oral health to overall health and general well-being. As the panelists said, you know, it's dental disease is an infectious transmissible disease that we can really fully prevent, so it makes it even more tragic that we have so many suffering from preventable dental disease. And given the fact that there is an oral health access crisis and that many in workforce experts have said that there's a dentist shortage and a rapidly growing number of hygienists, ADHA has called for an advanced dental hygiene practitioner. We appreciate Jack's description of it. And it's a licensed dental hygienist who would go back and get a master's degree in clinical dental hygiene, adding to the current preventive scope of practice of hygienists, limited restorative and prescriptive authority. And there are some other proposals for new models, and the CHIPRA bill called for a study of some of these, and was wondering if Bill could comment on the ADA's view with respect to new workforce models and whether or not new providers should be licensed and graduate from accredited institutions, and whether they think Congress might want to spend some money studying some of these new models. And then just real quickly, that Minnesota law, Bill's right, it does direct a work group to come up with a new oral health practitioner, and the scope of practice that that work group's supposed to incorporate is very similar to the advanced dental hygiene practitioner.
The ADA over the past few years had two work groups that came together to look at this issue of whether we need an additional member of the dental team. You know, we took testimony from a variety of different sources, including the hygiene community. The position that we derived and that we came up with is called the Community Dental Health Coordinator. And the idea is to basically merge a social worker with some dental education, some dental training to help be an extender in underserved areas and into communities where there aren't, enough dentists to try and get out into that community, make sure that people know of the importance of oral health, develop, increase their oral health literacy, and help kind of triage and get those patients to dentists so they can get the care that they, they need. That's the approach that we think is our best guess about what is needed to try and do this. There obviously are other proposals. Karen mentioned one. Ours is in fully vetted. We're actually in the process now trying to do demonstration projects in three different areas of the country in three different settings to determine its viability and to determine whether it's going to work. I don't know that you can tell from just, drawing something on a piece of paper and deciding this sounds good, whether it's actually going to be effective. So I think, the story hasn't been written yet in terms of determining what new member of the dental team is going to work best. I think these things are blooming around the country at the state level. We've heard that there's an effort afoot in Minnesota. There are other proposals going on. We're testing ours. I think that it's going to take some time to figure out which new member of the dental team is going to work best.
I might point out that, as I said before, 4,500 students graduate annually from dental schools. 23,000 allied dental health professionals graduate annually. So the workforce, the potential workforce, is significant. And as Bill said, it's a matter of figuring out exactly what the scope of practice is with regard to their activities. But there's no doubt in our mind that there are new functions and new responsibilities
that allied dental health professionals are going to assume.
Ed, if I can close, the one concern I have, you know, with this, you know, this workforce debate and scope of practice, as we all know, is a very, very contentious issue, whether it's, you know, in the dental field or in the medical field. It occupies a lot of, you know, of the political air in state legislatures. There's always, you know, turf battles going on. One of the things that concerns me most about it, and which, you know, I hope we don't, you know, continue to do is it gives legislators the opportunity to try and, you know, latch on to workforce and the creation of a new model or of a new program as their quick and easy solution to the access to oral care problem, diverting time and attention away from what we all know and from what I've said 100 times already in the last 2 hours, which is you've got to do the hard work of increasing reimbursement and devoting more funding to these programs, to building up the public health infrastructure. So, you know, what I don't want us to see us do is to give legislators that easy answer of saying, oh, all you have to do is flip this switch, create this new provider, and all the problems go away, because it's not going to happen.
My name is Tim Anderson. I'm actually a current dental student at the University of Minnesota, so I'm fairly familiar with this topic. My question goes out to Mr. Bursch and Parrish. You'd mentioned that your DIA's responsibility is for setting the curriculum for allied dental professionals. And my question is, with this new advanced dental hygiene practitioner, the scope of practice is vastly increased. And a concern that dental students are currently having is who's going to be teaching that, because we're no longer talking about preventative care in the sense of seeing fluoridation and sealants. We're talking about surgeries and the removable, permanent, irreversible removal of tissue. And my concern is that you'd mentioned that there's such a shortage of dental faculty. Who do you see as the person or persons who are going to be responsible for educating these new practitioners? If it's not the dentists or dental faculty training them, who's going to be responsible for teaching surgery?
Well, you've identified the challenge, and there is a dearth faculty available for teaching, especially the ADHP model. As I said, we don't have a dog in this fight. We're going to teach what state legislator and federal legislators tell us to teach relative to what model is accepted. But you do put your finger on a significant challenge, and that is who is going to teach this new this new model of workforce. I don't have the answer other than to say it's a challenge, and it's an issue that's going to have to be addressed if this model moves forward.
Hi, my name is Piali Roy, and I'm from New York University College of Dentistry. I'm a third-year dental student. I actually have the question in lieu with Tim. I was just wondering, my question is towards Mr. Jack Bursch, ADA. Whether the curriculum for ADHP program has been developed or reviewed, and if it is reviewed, who is reviewing it, and the master's level course of ADHP program, what it will be containing of. Will it be a diagnosis-oriented extensive courses, or will it be clinical specialty like dental students do in residency?
Would you like to repeat that question?
The master's level course, ADHP course,
yes.
Or the program?
Yes.
Whether it will be diagnosis-oriented extensive courses or it will be clinical specialty?
I do think that the question should be addressed more properly to the American Dental Hygienist Association. They are the ones who proposed this workforce model. They are the ones who have created it. And our role, as I've mentioned at least twice, is not to support any particular model, but to teach whatever model is approved.
Thank you.
Jack, where are you going to get the faculty? You were talking about the shortage of faculty now.
In dental schools.
In dental schools. Are you engaged in some kind of a development program that would produce new young faculty?
It's a constant challenge.
The lure of private practice, the financial lure of private practice is significant. The salary level of academicians is certainly not at the level of private practicing professionals. We have attempted through a number of different ways to have faculty development, to increase faculty loan development, to forgive some loans, to encourage students to look more closely at an educational profession or career. It's in the present environment, it is a significant challenge. Many of the vacancies, while there are over 400, many of them are not being filled, obviously, and additional responsibilities are being burdened on the other faculty members. So it's one that we have paid attention to, but its total solution we have not yet found.
Diane, final word?
I just want to thank all of our panelists and all of you for what I think has been just the first step in our discussion of oral health. And so if Jack got us started and it took him this long to get us here, I think we'll be back very, very soon.
Thank you all.